Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how much does it matter that President Trump continually ticks off America's allies? First to the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Good morning, Ken. How are you?
Good morning, Carrie. Please do not tick me off during our segment.
Hey, did last week, from a news perspective, feel like about 4 weeks to you? It seemed like every day there was some new monumental thing, mostly coming out of the White House, I have to say. How'd it feel to you?
Well, yes, but I think I felt that for some time now. It seems like every time that it seems like it's going to slow down for a bit, there'll be either a tweet or some kind of a pronouncement coming out of the White House or a lawsuit or something like that, or some kind of foreign policy development that says, oh my goodness, how do we do this every day? And now it's not even, I mean, you do a show that's every day. I do a show once a week. When I was growing up, I would read Newsweek or Time. The thought of a weekly news magazine,
I know,
given the fact that things happen every hour, is just inconceivable.
Now, does what you've just said there about the tweets, the pronouncements, all of that, does that mean that the news media is overreacting on too much of this stuff that's coming out of the White House?
I don't think they're overreacting. I think they have to decide what's more important and what weighs more. But I guess I don't think maybe the media's role is not to just decide what's more monumental and just let everybody have it. I mean, there's always the accusation that's been out there that Donald Trump will do something to distract people from other things, like maybe he's doing this to distract from Robert Mueller or Stormy Daniels even. But I mean, all the things that are happening, the tariffs, the alienating of U.S. allies in the tariff policy, that is just as important. I don't know if it's just as important, but it's equally important, the fact that he goes to this very important rally in Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh on Saturday, because this is a key special election.
Right.
I think it's also very important that what's going on with Stormy Daniels is not about salacious facts, but it's a First Amendment right, whether they can stop CBS, for example, from running this interview. So everything is important. I don't know what's more important than the other. I think it's up to us to parse out what's going on and decide what's the most important thing.
Let me come back to the tariffs thing, because as you've noted, the president was in Pennsylvania in this special election, and that is a big issue in that state. What would you say to this question about whether the president and his fractious relationships with America's allies, most recently over tariffs, really matters? Or does the United States have enough power and influence that while the EU gets ticked off, in the long run, it's not really going to matter much?
No, I think the U.S. power and influence are waning around the world. And I think it's countries like China and Russia, especially China, that are taking up the slack. The fact that we're abdicating from trade deals and withdrawing from trade deals and climate deals, and it's other countries, again, like China, that is taking up the void of U.S. leadership. But I think it's almost everything. And the fact is that the president will more gladly do things and say things that will alienate allies like China and the EU, I'm sorry, like Canada and Mexico and the EU, and not alienate folks like Vladimir Putin, who seems to be incapable of insulting or doing the kind of thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Ken, this is the puzzling thing. We should say that he has a pretty warm relationship with the authoritarian leader in Egypt. He really likes Putin a lot. Europe is mad at him. Mexico is mad at him. He does have a warm relationship with Netanyahu of Israel, who is also now facing down a bunch of scandals. I don't see any real rhyme or reason. Maybe our next guest, Michael Waheed Hanna, will have something to say about this, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of rhyme or reason about who he decides he's going to be closest to.
Well, I think there is a rhyme or reason. He does seem to have an affinity for these authoritarian leaders, whether they're in the Philippines or Turkey. And with the fact that he said that, you know, he said this before, but the president said that we should execute drug dealers. I mean, that sounds like out of the Philippine playbook.
Yeah.
So
Duterte.
So, exactly. So, So there is something about this authoritarianism that he seems to like, the fact that he admired what's going on in China, and he made a joke about maybe he should be president for life. Some people were outraged by it. Others say that that was just a joke. But he seems to be more attracted to those kind of leaders.
You know, Ken, I want to bring in our other guest, because this is kind of an interesting part of the discussion, and I want him to make sure we get him in on this. Michael Waheed Hanna is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation with us from New York. Michael, hi. Bringing you in a little early, but I'm really curious as to what you have to say about the leaders that the president seems to be drawn to and whether it really matters that things are getting a little icy in Europe and other places.
I think, of course, it matters. These are our strongest alliances. I think they are key vehicles for the expression of constructive American power. And we do see, as we just heard, this affinity toward authoritarian leadership. And this is longstanding. I mean, you go back and read interviews after Tiananmen Square, reflecting on the actions taken by the Chinese Communist Party at the time. So this isn't something new. There is this this affinity to authoritarian leadership, and we see that in the ways in which he expresses comfort with leaders abroad. And of course, we do have this broad alienation among our strongest, most longstanding alliances and friendships. And I think that does undermine the ability of the United States to be a constructive actor on the international stage.
Michael, do you see this as more than just a disruptor who does not want to do business as usual for a number of different reasons? Primary among them, it seems to be because it's business as usual. Is it more than just what we should expect from a disruptor?
He clearly tapped into something. I mean, I wouldn't say that American foreign policy over the past 20 years has been on a healthy course. And we have things like our many years long engagement in Afghanistan that is not going well. And we have a disastrous Iraq war that began in 2003 and whose ramifications we are still dealing with. And so clearly, Trump tapped into some dissatisfaction alongside many other dissatisfactions. But that dissatisfaction with the foreign policy status quo, I think, was part of that broader message. But disruption in and of itself isn't a positive end. And in many ways, we've seen an intensification of the most problematic aspects of American foreign policy, a deepening of militaristic responses to events elsewhere. We see that in Afghanistan. We see that in Yemen. I would say in the fact that we approach Syria and Iraq mostly through a military lens. And so in some ways, we haven't seen positive disruption. We've seen, I think, a deepening of the more problematic aspects of American foreign policy and an undermining of the constructive elements of American policy in the sense that the positive relationships with multilateral actors and with key allies that allow us to hold out the hope for things like diplomacy, those things have been weakened.
Ken, you were going to say?
I was just going to add one thing to what Michael said, which I agree with completely, but the fact that the president would have this casual talk about bombing North Korea, you know, the kind of fire and fury that the world has never seen. Well, of course, the world has seen fire and fury. Go look at 1945. But the fact that he could be so casual about talking about bombing and nuclear weapons in North Korea when his own Secretary of State is in China at the time trying to talk about diplomacy is another part of his disrupting America First policy.
I know the North Koreans have long wanted a meeting with a president, but some of the rhetoric that the president has used in the past and the stuff you just referenced hasn't seemed to discourage, you know, a meeting coming up with the leader of North Korea. I mean, what's really the long-term or deeper effect of his rhetoric? Does it matter?
Well, I think it matters, but you know, you can make the case that, look, if something does come out of this meeting, if it really happens, a one-on-one between Kim and Trump, I mean, if you think of what all the other previous presidents have tried to do in vis-a-vis policy with North Korea, the Bush regime, the Obama, you know, Clinton, everybody else, nothing seems to have worked. there have been deals, there have been concessions,
right.
And North Korea would say, yes, we're in line with these kind of deals, and then they'll just break the deals. So, of course, it's very interesting how Donald Trump is so interested in breaking the deal, the nuclear deal with Iran, while at the same time hoping to negotiate a deal with Kim, who has shown over and over again his willingness to break deals.
You're listening to a discussion here, and I'm inviting you now to join in. Ken Rudin with us, of course, the political junkie, and Michael Waheed Hanna, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. We wanted to examine whether these tiffs and deeper disagreements that President Trump gets into with America's traditional allies really matter, and what are the long-term and the short-term effects of them? And then as you listen to this conversation develop, I'd like you to think about this. Does the U.S. remain so powerful and influential that it doesn't really matter if an American president, not just President Trump, but any American president, angers many of our allies? Does it matter that anti-Americanism is building in many countries around the world? So does it matter if the president is at odds with some of our traditional allies? Does it matter that anti-Americanism is building in other places in the world? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Michael, I want to ask you about this meeting with North Korea. I saw New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman on CNN Friday night, and she was saying the president is eager to take a meeting like this because he believes that he alone can charm anyone into anything, and he thinks he can use the force of his charm and his influence with the leader of North Korea. Is that kind of confidence valuable? Is it troubling? How do you see that?
In this context, I think it's slightly terrifying.
Why?
And it points to another
slightly,
aspect.
Slightly terrifying.
absolutely, because I've long advocated for engagement with enemies on a diplomatic level. I think for too long we've looked at diplomacy as a kind of bestowing of legitimacy on enemies. And I think that's the wrong approach to take to diplomacy. We undertake diplomacy for our own ends and for our own benefits. That being said, it takes a lot of groundwork and preparation. When this announcement was getting ready to be made by the South Koreans in Washington, the Department of Defense hadn't been notified. The idea that you can go into these very high-stakes negotiations, if we can call them that, talks, meetings, without any kind of real preparation, that the interagency process is hardly functioning when the stakes are so high. Because let's think about the very real possibility that this meeting doesn't result in a productive end. How does this president deal with disappointment? And that's what I find most troubling, because we've seen, as was mentioned earlier, this kind of rash rhetoric, and we've seen floated over and over again talk about limited military strikes on North Korea and this very hawkish approach. And so you put all that together. And I'm quite worried about what this meeting, if it happens, and if that's the other part of this, a lot of what we have heard declared in terms of the intentions of the Trump administration haven't come to fruition. So let's wait and see if it happens. But if it does, the idea that this very inexperienced, very uninterested observer of world affairs is somehow going to make a radical difference to a very intractable problem, I think is troubling when we think about the possibilities of what this meeting will produce.
Let me take a call here from Liz in Minneapolis. Hi, Liz. How are you thinking about the way American influence is diminishing in certain parts of the world? Does it bother you?
Yes. Hi. It does bother me. It seems to me that we're sort of watching ourselves, meaning America, decline in terms of power and authority across the world, which is particularly worrisome knowing that China, a communist country, is likely the one that's going to be stepping in and leading the leading power.
I mean, Ken, is that the vacuum that China, with its lifetime president now Xi, looks around the world and says, hey, if there's a vacuum, we can step into that and be more influential in some of these places the U.S. used to care about or had influence in?
I mean, Yeah, aside from the terrifying fact, as Michael said, the terrifying fact that the president feels like he could go it alone in meeting with Kim in North Korea because he can charm anyone, because he could work out a deal with anyone, is frightening enough. And one more thing regarding to what you said earlier, Kerry, about anti-Americanism building. We saw that around the world during our Vietnam War, which most of the world was opposed to our involvement there. We saw a lot of that during the George W. Bush presidency about his so-called cowboy diplomacy. But the fact is that until Donald Trump, every administration did believe in diplomacy. You had the James Bakers and the Condi Rices and the Colin Powells and others who, forget about whether their policies were unpopular, they never went out of their way to antagonize enemies. They kept our allies. They still worked together. It was still, I mean, when Bush went to war in Iraq and both the Persian Gulf and in the second Gulf and the Iraq War, there was an effort to at least reach out to our allies to make sure we were all on the same page. And right now, this president has no interest at all of doing that. It is a Donald Trump presidency. He is a Donald Trump Secretary of State. And it's not American foreign policy. It's Trump foreign policy. And he seems like he feels like he's the guy who could do it. But as we pointed out in this conversation, there are unbelievable amount of fearsome consequences that he apparently does not realize or care about.
Michael, let's take up what Ken just said about the Condoleezza Rices and the James Bakers. Yes, bringing a very experienced and knowledgeable approach to some intractable problems, and a lot of those problems remain unsolved. So, you know, the question that arises is there a different way perhaps to do this, and is President Trump, you know, pursuing that different way? And we can't say for sure that there won't be some kind of results from a different approach, can we?
Well, so I think there's two important points here. First, I would frame the first part of that last answer differently, in that I think we're looking at a cumulative erosion of trust. I do think the Iraq War, Guantanamo Bay, torture, these were things that shook our allies' faith in American leadership, and rightly so. I think we partially recovered from that. But now with the Trump administration and the behavior of that administration with our allies, I think there's a real question about the wisdom, not just of American leadership, but of American society that has produced this administration. And I think it's a cumulative erosion of trust and not something that's easily recoverable. When we think about the idea that a president of the United States cannot visit the United Kingdom, perhaps our closest and most longstanding ally, because of fear about public reaction, that's quite shocking. Now, if we look at the second part of this to address your question directly, things haven't gotten better. Well, that's often the case. I mean, I think we should be realistic about best case outcomes and not inject our view of the world with utopianism. It's very unlikely that North Korea is going to denuclearize. I mean, that's the bottom line for this president and this administration, as it has been stated. And we look at some of the objections to the nuclear deal with Iran, and complaints that we're essentially kicking the can down the road. And I think in many cases, kicking the can down the road is okay, is perhaps the best we can do with very complicated and, as we've said several times now, intractable situations. It's not all, some of these issues aren't solvable. And I think there's much to be much to disagree with the way that even American diplomacy has been practiced over many years. We can look at something like the Arab-Israeli conflict as a good example. But it's not necessarily, you know, I have very little faith that this version of a different way of approaching things is going to produce positive results.
Rich says on Twitter, Ken, what Trump says and does in regard to our allies or even in opposition to Western liberal values is important. Leaders, by and large, act in response to public opinion. Trump's public opinion polls in allied countries is abysmal. this will affect us. Ken, what do you make of that?
Sure. I mean, I agree. I agree that how we are seen around the world will affect us. And as we've talked about earlier, that there is certainly an economic and leadership void that China is filling. But at the same time, we are just losing what we've, I mean, since our creation, and certainly since the end of World War II, there has been a feeling about the United States that it is, I don't know about the good guys, but there is a leadership there that tries to keep sanity in the world. And it just seems like every new pronouncement, every new temper tantrum just loses our influence and loses our role as leader around the world. And it gives other countries and other leaders the opportunity to step in, which is exactly what's happening.
You know, Ken, I was thinking about what happened after the Iraq War. You know, President Bush angered many other countries and allies with invading Iraq and pursuing that war. Seemed like a lot of it was forgiven when President Obama was elected. I mean, I get the sense that this is temporary and often attached to the individual in the White House, not the White House itself. What's your take on that?
You know, what's interesting about that point is that I've gotten this question almost everywhere I go. And that question is, what happens after Trump? Assuming he does accede to a two-term limit or does, you know, value the importance of elections. But do we go back to normal? Do we ever go back to normal? Or are there Trump light or Trump heavy of people who follow him that say that the American people just, you know, are so used to this kind of leadership that we don't go back to the staid Bush, the thought of a Jeb Bush succeeding a Donald Trump is inconceivable. I just wonder if politics in the future, U.S. leadership in the future, doesn't go back, you know, just the way it went from Bush to Obama. Could it go back to normalcy after Donald Trump? A lot of people are concerned about that.
Ken, good to have you, as always, on Monday, and I'll talk to you next Monday. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
Michael, will you take up that question? President Bush angered a lot of people around the world. President Obama was able to smooth it over. Is it temporary, depending on who it is that's sitting in the White House?
It could be. I think, to harken back to something I mentioned earlier, I do think there is a cumulative erosion of trust. The United States has made grievous mistakes on the international stage that have been destabilizing of the very world order we have hoped to build up and fortify. The Iraq War, I think, being the most important example. And so Trump doesn't happen in a vacuum. So I think it is, I think, the most shocking development for allies looking to U.S. leadership, but it's not the first troubling development. And so we have this cumulative set of facts that will have to be overcome, and that's difficult. We've never seen a situation in which the political currents in the domestic societies of our allies point so strongly to defying the United States that it will end up being a very popular political position. And so recovering what we had previously isn't so simple. It's not an easy process. Clearly, any new leader will have a great benefit of the doubt on the international stage. And I'm sure we'll see hopefully we will see the ways in which that a future American leader will seek to differentiate themselves from the Trump administration. So there will be, I think, some receptivity to that. But again, it's building on the past, and that creates real barriers. And one last important point is context and the world, and that is that the world is changing. This isn't the immediate post-Cold War environment after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the United States was far and away the greatest power on the world stage and had a kind of unilateral moment that is not going to be revisited. We see rising powers. We see financial distress and dislocations throughout Europe and other parts of the world, the rise of China, a more assertive Russia. And this cumulative picture gives us a more chaotic and competitive world environment. And that context is quite important into how the United States can exercise leadership in the future.
Michael Waheed Hanna is with us for the remainder of this conversation. And as we talk about what it means that President Trump has alienated some of the United States' traditional allies, particularly most recently with these tariffs. The EU is quite angry about that. I want to talk to him on the other side of news about something that he just said about how foreign leaders react to the president. Fareed Zakaria wrote a really interesting piece in The Washington Post saying that foreign leaders can't be perceived to be surrendering into to the United States. And so they dig in, which kind of short circuits diplomacy or cooperation. As you listen to this, think about this question. Does it matter that anti-Americanism is building in many countries around the world? Does that have a real effect on the way the United States positions itself in the world? Let me grab a call here from Kathleen in Madison, Minnesota. Hey, Kathleen, how do you tackle this question?
Well, I guess I don't know about the tackling part, but I guess my point is that I guess I have a major problem with this idea not only of being concerned of the ramifications of these other countries, but considering that Donald Trump has yet to fill many State Department, positions, ambassadorships. I mean, you'll have Tillerson, in China, and he'll totally, pretty much shoot him in the foot, as well as almost what I consider the dismantling of our federal system and our procedures. And I would say that, this is not a reality show. This isn't where we just sit here and make a decision and say you're fired and that's the end of it.
Kathleen, you've brought up a really good point about the State Department that I hadn't gotten to yet. Michael, as she says, there's a lot of open positions. I think you mentioned earlier that the president often undermines Rex Tillerson. What does all that mean for ongoing and the kind of nitty-gritty diplomacy that we hope gets done every day?
It means that it's not happening in a lot of places, simply put. There is no ambassador in South Korea. There's no ambassador in Egypt, and that list goes on. And we've seen, I think, an abnormal number of resignations of senior career officials at the State Department and a consistent undermining of state under Rex Tillerson. And some of that has been done by Tillerson himself. But all that being said, it's a very troubling situation in that American diplomacy is hamstrung. There is no assistant secretary for the Near East. How then can you do diplomacy in the Middle East when that is the case? Personnel is policy. And in many cases, their personnel does not exist yet. And we've never seen anything like this number of vacancies this far into an administration. And we're not even hearing potential names for many of these positions.
But I guess, Michael, what I'm asking is, because we so often hear we've never seen anything like this, I guess I want to push past that and say, and does it matter that this is so different?
Yes, absolutely. And this is a key point. You can't do diplomacy. I mean, diplomacy is an activity that requires people. It requires process. It requires preparation. Those things don't exist. If you want to engage the Taliban and alongside the Afghan government in serious political negotiations over a way out of a war that began in 2001, you need people. You need an engaged interagency, and you need an engaged and proactive president. None of those things exist. And so, diplomacy is something that has to be a concerted activity. It is difficult and painstaking and often fails. And those processes aren't happening. And so you aren't going to see diplomatic results because we aren't doing diplomacy. And many of these key decisions are erratic. They haven't come after any kind of preparation. And of course, the lack of predictability, that erratic nature, is one other factor that is very disconcerting to those looking to the United States for leadership.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to the volatility because that's something that the president emphasizes and he thinks is an asset. But let me take a call here from Roxy in Wilton, North Dakota. Hi, Roxy. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thanks. I'll try not to stutter and stammer, but okay. I'm concerned about this article from David Brooks. I'm just looking at it now. And I dated it March 11th for our Bismarck Tribune. But the title is When the Political Center Collapses. And what he's doing, he starts out, he talks about what's going on in Italy, that element that really surfaced. And Trump is not going to go away in what he's brought forth to the United States, you know, the strong voices that have only gotten stronger. And so what's going to happen to the United States after Trump is gone? Are we going to recover, be a better country? What's going to happen?
What would you say, Michael?
Well, we have elections, and that'll tell us a lot. You know, if this is not a blip and not the exception but the beginning of a new norm, then that is a, for me, a very troubling possibility, something that I wouldn't like to see. And the caller mentions you know, political developments in Europe, and it's important to remember that Trump happens in this broader context where we do see, I think, the resurgence of a kind of demagogic populism that I find quite troubling. The roots of that are many and complex. But that is clearly the situation we find ourselves in. So Trump is not a total exception in that sense. I think we've seen other kinds of reactionary responses like Brexit in the UK that are part of this moment. But what happens next for the United States depends a lot on what kind of political leadership we as a society elect when we have a chance next.
Here's the piece that David Brooks wrote in just a couple days ago about what's happening in Italy. He says, what happens to American politics after Donald Trump? Do we snap back to normal or do things spin ever more widely out of control? The best indicator we have so far is the example of Italy since the reign of Silvia Berlusconi. And the main lesson there is that once the norms of acceptable behavior are violated and once the institutions of government are weakened, it is very hard to reestablish them. I know he's not making a one-on-one comparison between the way the U.S. runs and the way Italy runs, but do you accept that overall premise?
Yeah, I think so. You know, our norms, I would say the erosion of our norms of governance is something that predates Donald Trump. If we look at the way in which the nomination of, and this is to get slightly far afield, but I think it's relevant, but the way in which Merrick Garland's nomination for the Supreme Court was dealt with by the Senate, I think we can look at the idea that our norms have been eroded over time as something that happened before Donald Trump.
And we should say, just so everybody remembers that, we should say that the Senate basically refused to take up President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, saying they were going to wait
for
out
a
the
year,
election.
Effectively.
Right.
And so, you know, the question of governability has been, I think, on the agenda, our agenda collectively for some time. It is not brand new. It is not just a phenomenon associated with Trump. Clearly, those things have gotten worse. And we look at the ways in which I think very important political norms that that are often unstated in many ways, and have been assumptions of the ways in which we govern ourselves, whether it deals with conflicts of interest or corruption. I think many of those norms are being violated on a daily basis. Whether we can recover, again, it is an open question. And it depends on how we as a society and our political leadership responds to respond to these challenges in the future.
Jeff says on Twitter, and I think rightly so here, why isn't there more criticism directed at the U.S. Senate for holding up many of the appointments Trump has made? So it's true, Michael, that a lot of these jobs are unfilled, even with the nominees that the president has made, but the Senate is dragging its feet, too.
Not particularly. Not even remotely comparable to the situation of Senate delay during the Obama administration. This is a Republican Senate, and it's not as if there is a huge backlog of nominations that are waiting for Senate approval. That's not really the case.
The
fact is that we aren't seeing nominees coming through the pipeline. We haven't seen any kind of special and egregious delays on the part of the Senate.
Jeff included a piece here from the Business Insider that says Democrats are holding up the U.S. ambassador to Germany, the hearing for that. But there are some other low-level positions that have not been moving through the Senate very quickly. If I may just grab a call here from Tom in Montevideo. Sure. Hi, Tom. Thanks for waiting. What do you want to say?
Well, you know, I think we finally have a president who is so concerned about the United States, the employees, the companies. We have steel companies now that are reopening because of this situation with the steel and aluminum. We have companies that are growing, giving their people bonuses. As far as I'm concerned, when Obama and Hillary, I mean, they sold us out to everybody. So donations could be made to a certain foundation. I think it's good that we have somebody that is only concerned with growing our economy. And as far as diplomacy, I mean, come on. I mean, here, if you don't like it, that's too bad, because my president's job is to grow America and help America out, not every other country in the world.
Michael, that is the argument that the president makes. I mean, in his motto for the campaign, make America great again and focus most on domestic issues.
And it's wrong because we don't live in a zero-sum world. It matters what happens elsewhere. We don't do foreign policy and diplomacy as a charity. We do these things because they are good for the United States. And, you know, we can get into I don't want to get into a broader discussion about tariffs, but the preservation of a certain number of jobs in highly alienated segments of our society is something to think about. But there are real costs to that. And I think one of the big problems with the way that Trump approaches the international stage, and many of his supporters do as well, is that they view this in zero-sum terms, where the United States wins and other people lose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the way the world economy works. And it's not the way that we as Americans have thought about our place in the world for many decades. And on the whole, that has benefited the United States. Now, I understand that there are many grievances, particularly after the financial crisis of 2008, there are real grievances that need to be addressed, but this isn't the way to do it. And again, I think it's quite naive to think about American foreign policy as some kind of international charity exercise. We don't do this to benefit other societies. The main goal here is the advancement of American goods, and that is not done by alienating our key allies. Trade has a bad name, but it's an important aspect of how we've expanded American power and created jobs at home. And so I just think this kind of reactionary posture might be satisfying at a kind of instinctual, emotional level, but it is not one that is going to be particularly effective in advancing American interests.
Here's John on Twitter who says, I equate Trump to the enforcer on a hockey team, not the most skilled player, but plays a role in making sure other teams don't take cheap shots at his team. Not sure if this is the right approach, not sure about lasting damage. Here's a piece I wanted to ask you about, Michael, that Fareed Zakaria published in The Washington Post last year when he was taking a look at what it means to change the relationship with some of our allies. And he said, in foreign policy, great statesmen always keep in mind one crucial reality. Every country has its own domestic politics. crude rhetoric, outlandish demands, poorly thought through policies, and cheap shots all place foreign leaders in a box. They can't be perceived as surrendering to the United States, and certainly not to a nation led by someone who is determined to show that for the United States to win, others must lose. You just said that, zero-sum game. But speak to this idea of positioning other foreign leaders who, you know, have audiences in their own countries to satisfy and kind of boxing them in to a place where they can't pursue the kinds of policies that would also be helpful to the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned this earlier in the sense that domestic political incentives will push even leaders in our closest allies to defy the United States.
Can you think of an example of that, Michael?
Well, I mean, you know, if we look at the ways in which Trump is perceived abroad, we know that we look at Theresa May, the prime minister of the UK, and the ways in which she approaches her perhaps most important relationship as the UK goes through Brexit. And her being overly solicitous to this U.S. president is quite complicated because of the negative reactions it triggers throughout UK society. And so that's a key political consideration that they in the UK have to think about. And that's incomprehensible that the United States is seen in such a way in the UK that renders a visit of a U.S. president impossible under current political circumstances.
You know, I was thinking about
that
Mexico.
That should be very troubling.
I was thinking about Mexico, too. I mean, the rhetoric about Mexicans and immigrants and the wall has probably boxed in the president of Mexico, who might be more cooperative on some of these issues that really matter. Not that I'm saying they're going to pay for the wall, but, you know, on some of the other issues. But publicly, I wouldn't think that he could do anything like that for his own domestic politics.
Yeah, I think you make a very, very good point. And we look at the way that immigration enforcement has changed under this administration, and it becomes another factor that a country like Mexico has to consider. So dealing with the United States and attempting to be constructive with the Trump administration will have real domestic political costs for leaders abroad. And I think that's quite troubling. Engaging with the United States could be politically costly.
Kaden Mora called to say that she was part of a group called SPAN at the U of M. It was a student project to lay diplomatic ties, and she wonders whether we're losing that woven fabric of exchange students. She says she had a great experience. To John in Minneapolis. Hi, John. What's your question for Michael?
Hey, Michael. I'm curious about what America's been bold and a leader in the world for since the end of World War II, but it has not done that openly all the time. And when it has been open, say like Vietnam or Iran, it hasn't gone very well. And I'm just wondering, how do Russia and China, who played roles in so many of the things that happened in Southeast Asia, South America, Africa, how do they use the real grievances that people have worldwide about the way in which the United States held on to power this long against the United States, now that, you know, some of the scores have been maybe not settled, but the playing field has been more evened out? I'd be curious to know.
Interesting question there, Michael.
Well, I wouldn't reduce American influence and activities abroad to military engagements. I mean, it's not just the Vietnam War or the Iraq War. We have been crucial in the building of international institutions like the United Nations, like the International Monetary Fund, like the World Bank. When we talk about a kind of liberal international order, some people dismiss the very concept, but I think it has merit. The kind of international institutions that we've helped bring into place, the United States was quite important in post-war diplomacy in Europe and the eventual creation of what became the European Union. So we shouldn't reduce what our sense of what the United States can and should do in the world to military engagements. I mean, I think that's been a overemphasized tool in recent decades, something that we should try to rethink and get away from. And it's important to think about all of those potential activities as important facets of American foreign policy. We look at the ways in which our relationships with Mexico and Canada have changed over time. Those are important foreign policy achievements. That is a big part of what the United States does. It is not just about war and military engagements abroad.
Jerry says on Twitter, I think to echo what you've just said, the question is not does it matter, but how does it matter? When Russia messed with U.S. elections, state is depleted, it matters. How do we sustain democracy and diplomacy? Michael, I've got about 2 minutes left here, but I wanted to ask you, since we've covered so many different parts of the world, where is there a part of the world that you are most concerned about that really, I don't know, takes a back seat when it comes to some of this chaos and churn at state and some of what the president's focusing on? You see what I'm asking?
Well, I mean, I'd answer it slightly differently. I work primarily on the Middle East, mm-hmm. and for a long time, I have contended that we are overly invested in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And far from being a disruptor, this president has deepened and problematized our engagement in the Middle East. And so we haven't seen any kind of rebalancing. And much is happening elsewhere in the world if we look at Asia. And there was a sort of effort in the previous administration, the so-called pivot to Asia.
Yeah.
But beyond the cliche of that, I think it represented an important impulse that we need to be engaged more broadly. And the kind of myopia that has led to this over concentration in the Middle East isn't just not getting better. I think it's getting worse under this administration. We never hear say about engagement with Latin America and
right.
And South America.
Right.
I mean, these things aren't even part of the conversation, and I think that's worrisome. There are real opportunity costs to the way in which a president that lacks curiosity is going about his engagement with the world.
Michael, this has been really insightful. Thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael Waheed Hanna is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Hearing from a number of you on the shows that we did last week on the history of the gun debate and the Second Amendment, and investigative reporter Gene Lenzer on the medical device industry and whether the research and the regulation is high quality enough to protect you from the side effects of the medical devices that we use. Now, both of those shows are on podcasts. You can find them. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.